Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Add Mercedes-Benz to the list of car companies that might commit to California's strictest in the nation vehicle emissions regulations. Plus, a Republican assemblyman is trying to save the state GOP by searching for common ground.
This idea that if it's a Democratic idea, it's got to be a bad idea is wrong. Just as it is to say if it's a Republican idea, Democrats shouldn't think automatically it's wrong.
It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. You know what I love about Thursday? It's close proximity to Friday. But here's the thing. It is a Thursday and a Friday in Los Angeles, which always has the potential to be more exciting than anywhere else. For example, tonight at the Rose Bowl, it's the Rolling Stones. Then tomorrow, the New York Yankees are in town to take on the Dodgers, the teams with the two best records in all of baseball, giving us a possible World Series preview. Aren't you glad you live here? All right, speaking of Mick and the Boys, later in the show, we'll hear about the Stones' first ever show in the United States. It took place right here in Southern California, but not at a legendary venue. You're going to have to guess on that one, because the answer to that, we're going to have to head east to the IE. Hear all about it right here on Take Two a little later on the show. But first, let's start on the streets of Los Angeles with an issue that is perennial. The City Council's Homeless and Poverty Committee wants to replace the law that bans sitting or sleeping on the sidewalk with a rule that is more narrowly tailored. With us to talk about the proposal and its history is KPCC's housing and homelessness reporter, Matt Tinoco. Matt, welcome.
Hi.
All right. Tell us how we got to this point. What current laws are on the books about sitting or sleeping on the sidewalk in L.A.?
Sure. The city code we're talking about is 41.18. It's an anti-loitering ordinance pertaining to public right-of-ways, and it makes it a criminal offense to block, sit, lie, or sleep on the sidewalk. It's most often enforced against homeless people who are, you know, sitting on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. And in the last 12 months, LAPD has cited or arrested just over 1,500 people for some 41.18 violation. And the law, it's been legally contentious for a long time now.
In what way? How so?
It was contested in a major lawsuit between the ACLU and the city of L.A. back in the mid-2000s. That case was called Jones versus L.A., and it concluded actually with an out-of-court settlement. So L.A. agreed more or less only to enforce the law during the daytime, but to leave people alone between the hours of 9 p.m. and 6 a.m.
9 p.m., 6 a.m. So what changes then are being proposed now?
The changes, there's a lot of them. They're a little bit too long to enumerate everything here, but a synopsis would be that the changes would outlaw sitting or lying or sleeping on the sidewalk within 10 feet of a driveway or a building entrance if you're blocking the sidewalk in a way that violates the Americans with Disabilities Act, and then within 500 feet of a school, a park, a daycare center, or a homeless housing or shelter facility that's opened since the 1st of January in 2018. There are more provisions, but it's also just a proposal right now. So everything I just said could end up changing in the further process of the city's legislative process.
Okay. And why are they attempting to make these changes?
It's because of another court case. You might have heard of Martin v. Boise. That's the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on it last year and basically said Boise's prosecution of homeless people under its citywide ban on camping on public property amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. That's the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. They said this was especially cruel and unusual because Boise had no other homeless shelters available. The court basically said that broadly that cities can't criminalize homeless people for being homeless. And this proposal, the one that city council heard yesterday or in the committee, is LA's response to that lawsuit.
Okay, got it. Now, outside of Los Angeles, how have other cities responded to the case?
Well, a few cities like San Francisco, Sacramento, and Portland, Oregon have said they just stopped enforcing their citywide bans on camping or sleeping altogether. Locally, the Boise case is also the main case cited in Judge David Carter's orders to Orange County cities to increase the amount of shelter. The key point in Boise is that the sort of law enforcement against people who are homeless cannot occur if the local jurisdiction does not have enough shelter beds available to shelter everybody who's homeless in that jurisdiction. So, to come back to L.A., the last homeless count estimates that about 27,000 people are experiencing homelessness in the city of Los Angeles at any given time. thing is, the city has only about 8,000 shelter beds, and about half of those are reserved for families with children. So then that's about 4,000 beds for single adults in the city of Los Angeles, who make up the vast majority of the homeless population here.
It almost seems like L.A. would never have enough shelter beds. And Boise says the court said that they couldn't criminalize people experiencing homelessness. So how could the city write this rule at all?
That's the potentially several million dollar question. Yeah. There's this one note in the court's legal opinion where the court basically said, blanket citywide bans on sleeping are illegal, but there may be some circumstances where bans are appropriate at some times in some locations. The LA City Attorney representative at the meeting yesterday said or mentioned that note and said that the new proposed law basically tries to strike that balance.
Now, if this law goes into effect that limits where people can be on the sidewalk, what would change?
I really don't know the answer to that question. An advocate I spoke with at the meeting said that he thought it might end up cordoning people off into sort of containment zones, something like Skid Row, but all over the city where it would be legal. Another woman who was at LA City Hall was also particularly worried about the park provision, that you have to be more than 500 feet from parks, and then you also can't be in parks, because park bathrooms and drinking fountains are often the only facilities available for homeless folks. Outside of those 500-foot prohibitions I mentioned, the proposal doesn't ban sleeping in commercial or residential areas, so long as it fulfills other criteria. I think we're going to hear a lot more about it in coming weeks.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So what happens next?
Well, the proposal heard in committee yesterday is actually a request for the city attorney's office to draft an ordinance. So it still has to be approved by full council. And then when there is an actual ordinance, it would have to end up going through committee and the full council again. So we're at the beginning of this process, not the end.
All right. We'll check in again with KPCC's Matt Tinoco. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, staying with politics. Last month, California made a deal with four car makers, all of which pledged to cut vehicle emissions by 2025. To the Trump administration, it was a snub. The White House tried to get manufacturers on board with a forthcoming plan that would have given them more lenient standards. But automakers sided with our state, saying it's better to just make one version of a car that meets California's more stringent regulations. And now Mercedes-Benz will reportedly join the state's plan as well. For the latest, we have Coral Davenport. She covers energy and environmental policy for the New York Times. Hi.
Great to be with you.
All right. Now, the White House has been running in overdrive a bit, trying to convince other car makers not to join California's deal. What happened last month and who was there?
The automakers who have made the deal, I think, have kind of been iced out of the loop at the moment. But what this White House wants to do is make sure none of the other automakers join in. Because if enough other automakers join the California deal, if you get to more than half the U.S. auto market, you start to get to the point where the Trump rollback becomes irrelevant. So they summoned Toyota, GM, and Fiat Chrysler to the White House essentially to pressure them, like, hey, you guys, you better not do this.
And then on Tuesday, Governor Gavin Newsom confirmed that state officials here are talking to Mercedes-Benz about joining the pact, as well as one other company he would not name. Can you put us in the minds of those car makers, Coral? What's more attractive about being part of California's emissions plan instead of the looser standards planned by the Trump administration?
I keep using this word, but I want to stress it. What they are doing is extraordinary. To see automakers defy the federal government, defy the White House, that is a very hard decision to make. Why are they doing it? As they told the White House over and over and over in the negotiations for more than a year, they said, please do not roll back these standards for a couple of reasons. Again, they said that if you roll these back all the way, there is no question this is going to lead to litigation, to uncertainty. And here's another thing. Globally, standards like these are being put in place. The automakers are ready in order to be globally competitive. They're already investing in electric vehicles. They already are having to make high fuel economy vehicles to sell in other markets.
So they're looking beyond California and beyond our borders in the United States.
To their global competitiveness. Mm. So as one analyst put it to me, even though this is a really risky decision, the way it was put to me is, look, you know, the Trump administration, has an endpoint. California is forever.
We're talking to Coral Davenport. She covers energy and environmental policy for the New York Times. Now, for car buyers, the Trump administration argues that California's deal will mean more expensive cars. What does the math actually say?
Generally, the analysis and the math don't add up with the way the Trump administration has put this. A good way to look at this is Consumer Reports put out an analysis on this proposal a couple of weeks ago, and they said that the Obama rules that are now in place would save consumers about $660 billion, mostly in the cost that they would pay overall for gasoline, because these cars with higher fuel economy obviously require consumers to buy less gasoline. They did an analysis of what the Trump rules proposed and found that that would cost, it would lead to a cost of $460 billion.
So in total, we've got six automakers who are joining California's pack. They're going to account for over 40% of all the cars sold here in the United States. Are there any hints, though, of any manufacturers who are going to say, hey, we're going to hold out and stick with the White House emission standards?
From the conversations that the discussions and interviews I've had around what GM is going to do, I think there's a real question. I think if GM were to join, that could be a game changer. Mm. What I'm also hearing is I think what a lot of companies want to do is wait for the Trump rules to be final, because the Trump rule right now is still in its proposed form. You know, the table is still open. They could even go back to California and said, look, we'll cut a deal with you. It's unlikely, but it's still in that form. So the Trump rule is still a moving target. And I think that a lot of these auto companies are waiting to see what will be the final Trump rule. There are other companies who are saying, we would like to join with California, but the other thing that we want to do is we want to join in a group. The way it was described to me is, you know, no one wants to be the fifth one to do it by themselves, but no one wants to be the 17th one. So I think the companies want to sort of talk with each other and find, you know, I think that we might see another group of two, three, or four, maybe even more companies joining en masse so that kind of, you know, to achieve that critical mass.
And one of the wrinkle on this, as you've been reporting, part of the White House strategy on this issue is complicated by a lack of strong leadership on the inside. Tell us about that.
So within the Trump administration, the key top political appointees who have been working on this policy have recently left. The top clean air official at the EPA recently left while he was under investigation for possible ethics violations. In the Transportation Department, the top two officials who've been involved in this went over to the Justice Department. Another top official is expected to leave this week. Within the EPA, there's also a top career official, a guy named Chris Grundler, who is the expert on these issues, was recently transferred out. So there's really weak leadership.
And inexperienced leadership too, right?
Right. So the person who's kind of wrangling all of this right now is a guy in the White House, a 29-year-old aide named Francis Brook. He is widely described as very bright, but does not have a lot of hands-on experience in this area. And this is a vast, incredibly complex policy. It involves legal issues, scientific issues. On the other hand, other side of the table, California, the top clean air official in California, Mary Nichols, is a veteran of these issues. She has been working on them since the first Jerry Brown administration.
Wow.
she has relationships with the auto companies that go back years, if not decades. She knows how to negotiate. She's played this, I think, pretty skillfully, in part because I think a lot of industries don't love that California sets policy and pushes for stronger policy, but they also have a functional working relationship with the regulator who does it. And I think that that has helped California pull this off so far.
Yeah. What does this scenario tell you about California's ability to drive environmental policy from the opposite side of the country, all the way from California to D.C.?
California has been doing this for 40 years. California was a key player in the terms of the 1970 Clean Air Act, which to date is not just sort of one of the bedrock environmental laws in the United States, but actually in the world. That law gives California the legal authority to set its own stricter standards for air pollution. And because California, it's also the largest auto market, obviously, in the U.S. And so because it has that carve out that it negotiated back in 1970, because it is the largest auto market, California really does have the heft to negotiate with the federal government. But California historically has, particularly on issues of clean air, of air pollution, has been a very powerful player in influencing national policy. And we're seeing that again, but we're seeing it in a more extraordinary, unprecedented way than I've ever seen.
Now, if California gets its way, when can we as vehicle buyers start to see the results of this deal with car makers right there on the new car lots and on the freeways?
Well, this is set to start with model year 2020. So we'll see this play out in the next year.
Coral Davenport covers energy and environmental policy for the New York Times. Coral, thanks a lot.
Great to be with you.
Asking Twitter a question, even one you deem to be innocent, ooh boy, you better have some seriously thick skin when you read that answer, especially when you're a political minority in a state that has an adversarial relationship with a leader of your party. Chad Mays is a California GOP state assembly member repping Coachella Valley, and this week he asked Twitter, what does Republican mean to you? He got some pretty strong answers back. Hear what he says in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Assemblyman Chad Mays of Coachella Valley is a rare breed among his peers. He is one of the last moderate Republican lawmakers in the state. A 2017 vote to extend California's cap-and-trade program made him a political pariah. He was pressured to step down as leader of the Republican caucus. But despite the criticism he's faced from his own party, Mays continues to sing a common refrain. The California GOP needs to adapt or die. And all that leads us to Monday and a Twitter post that's turning heads. Mays tweeted, "What does Republican mean to you? A sincere question." What he got back? Nearly 12,000 responses, most of them negative. Now the Assemblyman is here to answer some of our questions. Assemblyman Chad Mays, welcome to Take Two.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Now, according to the Secretary of State's office, less than a quarter of voters in California are registered Republicans. So you might have assumed going into this tweet that you'd get at least a few negative responses. There were some positive ones in there as well. But did you think that the majority would be so negative?
I didn't. You know, I was sitting on the plane getting ready to come up to Sacramento and tweeted that, and I figured I would get somewhere between 30 to 50 responses to it. By midday, it had gotten to 400, 500, and then it just started to go from there. So by the end of the day, it was over 10,000. Quite fascinating. And go through and read them.
Yeah.
It's tough to hear that.
Yeah.
But I do believe for us Republicans here in this state, we are a dying breed. As you referenced, we have less than 0.25% of the people that are in the state are registered Republican. Democrats have pretty much held steady in the mid-40s since the mid-90s, and yet we went from the high 30s now down to less than 25%. Something's wrong, and we have to listen to the electorate, to listen to people, to think of what is it that they think about us, and then respond accordingly. I did not expect that type of a response.
Who was your intended audience with the question? Was it Republicans everywhere, fellow California GOPers, maybe even Democrats? Who were you asking this question to?
Well, I really was, asking anybody. You know, I think Republicans have a viewpoint on what it is that Republican means. Independents have a viewpoint, and Democrats have a viewpoint. I wanted to hear from everyone. It's interesting if you go, so most of those were negative, of course, but if you go and you look at some of the, I'm guessing they're conservatives, and they would reference things like, you know, Republicans believe in freedom and free markets and low taxes and limited government, which you would hope that they would say.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you hear from folks on the left, and it has nothing to do with policy. It has to do with this belief that somehow Republicans are racist, they're xenophobic, they're white supremacists, they're white nationalists, yeah. and that disparity between the two viewpoints is instructive.
Well, I picked out a few of the negative ones. I'm sure you've read them, Assemblymember, but I want to read them for our audience for a second. Yeah. At Carol Vernon 7 said, GOP, greedy old predators. At Sassy Girl 914 said, everything that is wrong with modern politics. John R. Johnson, party over country. Dave Jensen said, I don't know anymore, which is why I left the party in 2016. And one last one, David Hoffman, who said, it used to mean fiscally conservative, individual and local rights, but now there are only two words to describe Republicanism, greedy and racist. Assemblyman Mays, as a Republican elected official, how do those comments make you feel?
Well, I don't like that at all. In fact, when I listen to that and being identified, having the label of being a Republican, I don't identify with any of that. But that's not the point. The point is there are people that sincerely believe that. And so whether I like to think that that's not the case, there are still an awful lot of people that do. That is a challenge for us and for Republicans just to say, oh, that doesn't matter. Those are people on the left. That's the, you know, the lamestream media that are bringing all this stuff up. That doesn't matter. Well, I'll tell you, it does matter. And it matters every 2 years in California when Republicans keep getting beat over and over and over again. One thing I think is incredibly important for us, and I think it's a fundamental value, not just for us here in the United States, but across the world, is this belief that no one is more superior than someone else, that we are all intrinsically valued the same. And yet there are people, like you just pointed out, that believe that Republicans think that if you're one particular race or one particular ethnicity, that you're more valuable. That's got to stop. It has to stop. That cannot be who we are. And if it is who we are, we've got an awful lot of soul searching to be able to do. And so we're going to respond to it.
As I mentioned earlier, your work with Democrats on things such as cap and trade has brought you some heat from your own party. Now, six other Republicans voted for it, too. But I want to ask, why do you think asking Republican leaders here to work with Democrats is such a tough sell?
Well, it shouldn't be. What most folks don't realize is that there were 15 Republicans in the assembly that supported that deal. There ended up only being seven who actually voted for it. This idea that if it's a Democratic idea, it's got to be a bad idea is wrong. Just as it is to say if it's a Republican idea, Democrats shouldn't think automatically it's wrong. You know, our job here in the legislature or for the folks back in D.C., their job is to try to create an environment where people can have a better quality of life. We've lost sight of that. That's what politics should be. It's not a game. This is about real life. And the policies that we put in place affect real people. Who cares whether you're a Democrat or who cares whether you're Republican when you're an elected official? The goal should be, how do we create policies that are going to make people's lives better? And it's unfortunate that our politics today has gotten to a place of, if I'm on Team Republican, I have to hate Team Democrat.
We're talking to California State Assembly Member Chad Mays, who earlier this week tweeted out a question, what does Republican mean to you? Of course, I got to ask you about the President Trump factor. Earlier this month, after dual mass shootings, you tweeted, quote, Republicans must reject racism, xenophobia, nationalism, and white supremacy. The president has been criticized for not condemning those things enough. So I'll just ask, is President Trump bad for California's Republican Party?
Yes, I think that is abundantly clear. Whether you love him or you don't love him, it is abundantly clear that Trump has not been good for California Republicans. To be fair, and I want to be fair, the decline that we've seen in the California Republican Party did not start with Trump. The decline was happening for decades before that. It just began to speed up once Trump got elected to office. And we've seen the decline go quickly since he's become president.
But I think anyone can see that state lawmakers are in a bit of a tough spot if they're forced to choose between the state party and the national party. So in your view, what are the more pressing issues that you think California Republicans need to stand up to the president over?
Well, look, there's a whole host of them. You know, I can think of the tariffs. You know, I'm a big believer in free trade. I think it's had a negative impact on agriculture, on our farmers here in in California. And I can start talking about affordable housing. I could talk about public safety. I could talk about the state of our education system here in California. The difficulty is, and this is what I've found over the last couple of years, is that that's not the question that people want to know. The first question is, well, that's great. You want to talk about affordable housing, but are you do you support Trump or are you against Trump? And by the way, I think that's a shame, too, because there are some policies that need to be fixed here in California. And this shouldn't be all about one individual back in Washington, D.C. We should be able to have a real clear debate, and it should be a civil debate on the issues.
One last thing, Assemblyman Mays. Justin Amash was a Republican congressional representative from Michigan. He opposed President Trump's nomination. He's been a very vocal critic of the president, even supported impeachment. Last month, he quit the GOP, and he is now an independent. You have said that the GOP has a negative, toxic brand. If things do not change, might we see you head down the same road as Justin Amash?
You know, I thought about that an awful lot. Today, there are two political parties in the country. There are Democrats and there are Republicans. I wish that there was a third way, but today there isn't a third way. And so the question is, in becoming an independent, do you lose your voice in trying to fix the Republican Party? Do I continue to stay in the Republican Party to fight to try to make it better? Or do you walk away? And that's a question that I think about almost every day.
You can tell me, which way are you leaning?
You know, one day it's like, oh, my goodness, I can't take it any longer. And the next day, I think I got to continue to keep fighting the fight. And so for now, and as we're talking right now, I'm going to continue to keep fighting the fight.
That's Assemblyman Chad Mays on a mission to transform the California Republican Party. Assemblyman Mays, thank you very much. And we hope to check in on your progress.
Yeah, that'd be great. I appreciate it.
All right, now to what could be unsettling news to some homeowners. The California Department of Insurance says the 10 California counties with the highest fire risk also had the highest percentage of homeowner policies dropped last year. Bob Moffitt with Capital Public Radio reports from Sacramento.
The counties most prone to wildfire saw a 10% increase in dropped policies last year. Michael Soller with the California Department of Insurance says it would like to work with insurance companies to provide coverage for all homes in exchange for statewide fire protection standards.
There is no one recognized statewide standard for a hardened home, for accessibility to a fire station and roads. It's a patchwork of different policies around the state, and insurers don't recognize those home hardening measures that do exist.
Mark Sechnin with the American Property Casualty Insurance Association says the industry would need to see proof of the effectiveness of such standards before insurers would agree to cover everyone.
We need to understand that this is beyond just an individual property. Well, everybody should do it because you want to protect your most important asset, which is your house. We also need to understand this needs to be done on a community basis.
While insurance companies canceled nearly 168,000 policies last year, more than four times as many people left their insurance companies. The Department of Insurance did not say how many of those people found a new company to cover them, but there were more new policies written last year than policies canceled. CAL FIRE says there were more than 16,000 homes that were destroyed by fire last year. I'm Bob Moffitt in Sacramento.
Trash Day in LA is the best day of the week because the city takes all the stuff you don't want anymore and you get a clean slate. But you know the routine.
Once upon a time, when you had waste, you had to separate it into several different types. Now, if this any sounds familiar, it is, but it isn't.
Turns out separating trash is not a new thing. It goes back a long way here in LA. Find out how far back when Take Two continues.
Thank you.
back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It's Thursday, which means time to throw back to some Los Angeles history.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
And today we're taking a closer look at L.A.'s garbage system and the difference between rubbish, garbage, and scrap. And for more on the way the trash system used to work here, we have Michael Holland. He's a Los Angeles City archivist. Michael, welcome to Take Two.
Nice to be here, Ray.
All right, now to kick us off, I'm going to play a clip from the 1933 film Luncheon at 12.
Well, Mr. Zeisman, just back down the street. If you want your asses hauled, you leave your can outside your own house. Why, that's ridiculous. What difference does it make? No difference at all. It's just the principle of the thing, that's all. Go on.
Now, the movie shows a man running after a garbage truck trying to get his ashes, that's right, his ashes hauled away, which probably doesn't make a lot of sense to many Angelenos today. So, Michael, lay it out for us. What did L.A.'s waste system look like before 1957? Set the scene for us.
Once upon a time, when you had waste that you had to dispose of, you had to separate it into several different types of material. Now, if this any sounds familiar, it is, but it isn't. The first one would have been called garbage.
Okay.
Now, garbage, in that definition, was food scraps, food waste.
Okay.
The reason for that is the garbage would be collected by a garbage truck, and the garbage would be taken out to pig farms.
Oh, well, wow. Pig farms. Okay.
Pig farms. There used to be pig farms in Los Angeles County and beyond, and so the garbage would be taken out to the pig farms to feed the pigs. Now, scrap is what we would refer to nowadays as recyclables, tin cans, bottles, fabric, those sorts of things that could be collected by another truck. And then they would be separated at a foundry to be melted down and reused, or the fabric could be cleaned up and used for mattress stuffing or any other sort of thing you can imagine cloth being used for.
Okay, makes sense so far.
So far, so good. Now, rubbish, on the other hand, was basically anything else. So it was not it was not edible. It was not recyclable. But rubbish could either be collected, or what a lot of people used to do is they would burn it. There used to be a feature of a lot of backyards and apartment buildings all over, not just Southern California, but all over, backyard incinerators.
Yeah, I remember. Hearing about those, yeah.
Yeah, my grandparents in Hawthorne actually had one of these things in their backyard, never used it. I never was curious enough to ask what it was there for, and so it wasn't until years later I discovered what it was used for. And so anything that you could burn, whether it was paper, wood, again, any materials that didn't fit any of those categories, you could then burn. You could then collect the ashes, put them in an ash can, and set that out on trash day, and it would be picked up. Again, by a third truck, completely different from the other two. And then the ashes would all be hauled off to the city incinerator, which was near Vernon. And the surrounding property was basically an excavated gravel pit. And the ashes would be dumped into that gravel pit, along with the ashes that the incinerator itself was creating,
wow,
as was burning stuff it had collected from other cities and basically people they'd contracted with.
My grandparents' house in Koreatown was built in the early teens. There used to be a space for an incinerator. My grandparents made a garden out of that spot.
Yep.
But yeah, that's the way it used to be if you lived in L.A. way, way back.
Sure. Absolutely. And that didn't change really until 1957 when incinerators were completely banned. There had been a slow progression of legislation starting with some of the county territory and then individual independent cities against either curtailing the hours that incinerators could be used. Mm-hmm. And it got really silly at times. I mean, you had to pay attention to which way the wind was blowing.
So what happened then to all the incinerator plants? Yeah, the wind is blowing and you don't want to be downwind of that. But what happened to those plants?
That eventually got closed down.
Okay.
And I believe that's probably landfill, which was what it evolved into. Because what happened was by the 1950s, of course, one of the byproducts of burning trash was air pollution. And it had gotten chronically bad. I mean, all the stereotypical mythology of smoggy Los Angeles was actually created about that time because you had oil refineries and foundries and factories. You had more and more automobiles every year. And you had this backyard trash burning. And so all of those things put together gave us that smoggy reputation that we're still trying to deal with even at this day.
But for once, the automobile doesn't take the whole blame.
No, the automobile was not the villain number one. The villain number one was originally the foundries and oil refineries and smokestack industries. And they were eventually cleaned up or curtailed, or they moved on to places outside Los Angeles County's control. So by the time the mid-50s comes around, there's enough of a grassroots movement to ban the things outright and to clean up the air. And so by the late 1950s, there was enough political will to stop the incineration of trash altogether. Now the question is, what do you do with it?
Yeah. Well, before we get to that, let's get into that political will for a second. Because after the incinerators were outlawed in 1957, Sam Yorty's campaign for L.A. mayor changed waste management once again. And he ran on a promise about the garbage system that in part got him elected. So what can you tell us about that?
Okay. When Yorty was running for mayor against Norris Paulson, who was the mayor at the time, who had introduced the incinerator ban, some of Yorty's larger supporters was the waste industry located in the San Fernando Valley and in other areas. And so he basically got a lot of financial support from them to push this idea that you elect me, we will come up with a plan to where you will not have to sort your trash.
Wow.
That had been something that people had complained decades. You know, why do we have to sort the bottles and the cans and sort it from this and sort it from that? I mean, you know, you can imagine that kind of conversation going on, in all quarters. And so now here is something that you don't have to think about. Just put it out. Put it out on the curb on trash day. We'll take care of it. You'll never see it. You'll never have to know what happened to it.
That's slightly genius to campaign on. I will make your life easier for Sam Yorty.
That was definitely one of the ways that he got into office was on that particular promise. And he actually did pull it off.
So let's bring it back to the present then. How has the past shaped our waste management today in L.A.?
We're looking at some very interesting times with waste management and recycling. For example, recycling isn't as profitable as it used to be. And so that means that, well, recycling is a great idea. It's a noble idea, but how's it going to work? How are we going to make it profitable again? We don't want to go back to burning stuff. You know, we don't want to go back to doing that. So whatever's going to come next is going to have to be not a plan A. Let's say that was the original trash, rubbish, refuse, scrap model. And then the landfill model is B. The recycling is now C. So what's going to be D? What comes next? We don't know that yet, which is why I think some of the history that is behind this and other topics can inform, in fact, what we do going forward.
Michael Holland is the Los Angeles City Archivist. He's been speaking with us today regarding the history of the city's waste management system. Michael, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I can't help but remember the one time I saw the Rolling Stones live. It was a crisp and cool October night, 1989, in the L.A. Memorial Coliseum for 17-year-old A. Martinez, a lowercase a. They were in the middle of the Steel Wheels Urban Jungle Tour. Living Color was the opening act. Guns N' Roses followed. Then the Rolling Stones. Coming up next with Mick and the Boys in the Rose Bowl tonight, just a few hours away from their show, hear the story behind the first Stones show on U.S. soil in San Bernardino. That's next when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Tonight, the Rolling Stones return to the Rose Bowl for the first time since 1994. The No Filter Tour marks the 55th anniversary of the band's first tour in the U.S., but did you know that the first ever concert the band performed in the States took place right here in California? No, not at the Hollywood Bowl, not at the Troubadour, but in San Bernardino. From the archives, here's former KPCC producer Kevin Ferguson with that story.
It's spring, 1964. At the time, San Bernardino basically had one place for rock shows, the Swing Auditorium on E Street, a 6,000-capacity dance hall that, before the Stones, hosted Bob Hope, Jack Benny, all pretty tame stuff, until Bob Lewis came around.
I'm retired. I'm a retired concert promoter.
Bob had set up dozens of rock and roll shows in the Inland Empire already, but that spring he was approached by a couple investors looking to put on a concert on Friday, June 5th, at the Swing.
And of course they wanted the Beatles.
Which wasn't as crazy as an idea back then as it seems now. He made a few calls to New York, but alas, no dice. The Beatles were booked, and he hung up. But word got around, and about an hour later he got a call from Kevin Eggers, another talent agent who heard Lewis was looking to book a British band.
He said, I've got an act coming to the States called the Rolling Stones. Never heard of them. Never heard of the Rolling Stones. So I called the radio station, KMN, the general manager, and I said, Jerry, I've got an act coming in. I want to see what you think, because I'd have to have their sponsorship. So he repeated over the phone, Rolling Stones, and his program director was walking by his office, and he said, the Rolling Stones, he said, they're really hot.
The show was booked, and the Stones were on their way to make their U.S. debut in San Bernardino, a city more famous today for its messy finances than its contribution to the arts.
I want you back.
At the time, the Rolling Stones weren't nearly as famous as they are now. They'd had a couple hit singles in the UK, all of them covers except for one original, a sunny and acoustic pop tune called Tell Me.
Tell me you're coming back to me, you gotta tell me you're coming.
Despite all that, they still had a few loyal fans in the States. After all, this was the British invasion. Laurie Gastineau is a retired high school English teacher, but in 1964, she was just a high school student, only 15 years old back then, and living in nearby Colton. For Laurie and her friends, this was the highlight of their month.
Well, they were an up-and-coming band. We, of course, listened to the Beatles, and then we started listening to all of the groups that came from England. We loved the beat, we loved the lyrics, and with the Stones, it was a new take on some old classics from blues and such.
And she came slow, walking the dog.
The band had just arrived in the States a few days earlier, performing on Dean Martin's Hollywood Palace show. He wasn't impressed. The only thing rolling were Dean Martin's eyes.
Rolling Stones, aren't they great? We'll have a short intermission, and we'll be back in Hollywood Palace in about a minute. Now, don't go away. You wouldn't leave me here alone with the Rolling Stones.
That Friday, the band arrived in San Bernardino.
And they got in around 5 o'clock. They did a very brief sound check, very basic, you know, testing 1, 2, 3, 4, and then they just stayed in the dressing rooms till they were ready to go on.
Laurie Gastineau and her friends started lining up at the Swing not long after the Stones sound check.
When the doors opened, we all made our mad rush toward the stage.
The audience was 4,000 strong and largely made up of teenage girls, not much older than Laurie. After hours of waiting, around 9:30, the Rolling Stones walked on stage. They opened with a Buddy Holly cover. The room was hot, Mick danced, the girls screamed. Gastineau says the highlight of the night for her and other locals happened about halfway through the band's set.
And of course, the favorite song that they played was Route 66, because San Bernardino was mentioned in that song.
How did the room respond?
Oh, we all knew the lyrics of all the songs, and so we all screamed especially loud when they got to San Bernardino.
The Rolling Stones' 11-song set at the Swing lasted just over 20 minutes.
That was their total repertoire. That was it. They didn't rehearse a lot. After a 20-minute set, the show's over, and the Stones did their London exit, which they just dropped their equipment, ran out, and we had a school bus. We didn't have limousines then. We didn't have a budget for limousines. So we put them in a little yellow school bus that we thought would get them in and get them out of town sort of unnoticed, which worked.
The Stones wrapped up that first tour with less than a dozen dates. While they may have been a hit in San Bernardino, the rest of the tour was by all accounts a failure. More awkward TV appearances followed, a couple of state fairs with indifferent audiences. But in 1965, they put out Satisfaction, and that was that. The Rolling Stones would go on to play the Swing Auditorium at least once more. In 1981, the year Start Me Up came out, they planned to come back to the Swing for one more show. That never happened. A plane crashed into the auditorium on September 11th of that year. The damage to the building was so severe, it was never rebuilt. Bob Lewis, the promoter, still keeps a small piece of the stage at his home in Claremont. When I interviewed Lori Gastineau, we met near the site where the Swing once stood. It's a parking lot now. She not only remembers the first Stone show at the Swing, but the second one, that same year. Her future husband, Jim, was in the opening band. She said she was heartbroken to see the Swing go, but happy for the memories.
Knowing that that particular band, the Rolling Stones, is still around today, that's kind of special, knowing that we were at the very first United States concert.
Kevin Ferguson, 89.3 KPCC.
About tonight's concert at the Rose Bowl, we're sending a lucky KPCC member to the show, and the winner of the ticket sweepstakes is Peg Consian from Lake Balboa. Peg is a proud, longtime listener and contributor. Congratulations, Peg, and thanks to everyone who donated to get in on the sweepstakes. Keep listening to KPCC for LA News and NPR, and every once in a while, a chance to win some pretty awesome tickets. As we wrap up today, we head to Laurel Canyon. Longtime residents there are fired up over a fine recently levied at their beloved Laurel Canyon Country Store over some murals that have been on the walls of the shop for years.
There is, in fact, some ridiculous code at the Department of Building and Safety that prevents this store from having a banner or basically any signage on the store that's more than 100 square feet that is not permitted and paid for or declared art.
That's Kristen Stavola, executive director of We Are Laurel Canyon, a nonprofit which organizes events for the community. The Los Angeles Department of Building and Safety recently found a banner and several murals in violation of an LA city code. She says the neighborhood is in the process of getting right with the city, but adds that process is not an easy one and puts a stress on the owner of the store and also on the artists who painted the murals. After the Labor Day weekend, the Los Angeles Department of Cultural Affairs is expected to evaluate the murals to determine if the murals classify as art. We have a call into the Building and Safety Department to get a sense of what happens next here, but according to Savola, the city's inspector says artists must have their applications in by September 4th. Residents will host a sit-in this Saturday to show they're committed to preserving the local artist murals that the country store has embraced for decades. Two great shows in Pasadena today. This one, the one that just happened, and then, yeah, those guys at the Rose Bowl later tonight. But if you missed any part of today's show, just head to wherever you get your podcast. We'll be right there smiling, waving at you, ready to be listened to. We're also on social media, @Take2. I'm there as well, @AMartinezLA. That's @AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.